So thank you for coming on this last day of ASAP. You know, I think it takes a great party or rather a really academic person who can make it through four successful nights and still show up to lectures. I was expecting about seven people, so you guys have exceeded my expectations. By way of background, I'm a chairman at the Virginia Hospital Center that's in Arlington, Virginia. I've been a chairman for about 10 years. Prior to that, I was a vice chair for 5 years or so. I've probably interviewed well over 100 people and probably hired or seen new people start probably 20 to 30 of them over the last 15 years or so. I also write the column, The Director's Corner, for Emergency Physicians Monthly. That's the one with Mark Plaster and Greg Henry. So I write Director's Corner in that, and hopefully you guys have seen that. That came out, I have a book that came out about a year ago, and this lecture is included in the book as one of the columns that I've done. Always looking for topic ideas, so if you have anything, feel free to email me. I have no financial disclosure, so let's go ahead and get started. So there are lots of opportunities to screw up. You can do it in the clinical arena. There's the politics of the hospital and the emergency department. There's the internet. And then there's relationships, nursing and social relationships. Most of those have to do with communication. We're going to talk about those. But in the interest of trying to keep this positive, what I want to do is I'm going to really try hard to not use the words don't screw up here. I'm going to say what to do in your first year and also give you some ideas on how to protect yourself. So just by way, by show of hands, let me see who's in the audience. Who's a senior resident looking for a job and expects to be a new attending? All right, perfect. This is geared towards you. Other residents, raise your hands, that won't be looking for a job next summer. All right, so we've got some other residents. How about attendings? Any first-year attendings? All right, good. So you're in your third month, probably by the third month. Generated one complaint, so we'll see if we can give you some information. And any more experienced attendings, more than 1 or 2 years? Anybody out there? I know I got some friends in the background who are old. They're not going to raise their hands. Any others? All right, so for those of you that didn't raise your hands that have 5 or more years of experience, tell me at the end what I'm leaving off, because I'm sure there's other things that I've not included. All right, so let's start with a timeline. It's fall. All of you senior residents, you're now interviewing. Number one is be nice to everyone. Don't insult people. Don't be rude to anyone, particularly my office. My relationship with our ED clerical administrator or ED secretaries, it's much stronger than my relationship with you right now. And it's amazing how many people come into the office and are rude to the people that they meet first for them getting into my office. I guarantee you, if you're rude to someone along the way, they will tell me. I don't want to hire anyone who's rude. The patients aren't going to like you. The staff may not like you. So start off just by being nice. In your interview, I think it's really important that you cover some basics. You know, what are the expectations of the department? What's the holidays and nights and weekends going to look like? What are the clinical priorities? How is it going to focus on productivity or core measures or patient satisfaction? And how does that really go with what you're interested in, what your philosophy is? All right, so you have your job. You're getting ready to get credentialed. And there's a mountain of paperwork. Now, you're going to get something in the mail about this thick. It's going to be about 1,000 signatures, lots of forms, lots of requests. You have to get this done. You're going to be given a deadline to get this done. The reason that you have a deadline is that the credentialing process on the hospital side, it takes months. Typically, you expect about 3 months. There are some hospitals where it's probably 6 to 9 months even to get credentialed. Credentialing is one of those hot-button topics right now in kind of the medical staff world and hospital administration world because people are getting credentialed and then leading to other problems. So if you are a troubled provider in your past and it doesn't get picked up and then there's a problem, the hospital can find itself being sued for not looking into your background closely enough. So you have to plan for delays on the hospital side. If I give you a deadline of February 1st, you've signed your contract, you're doing the paperwork, and you know that's the deadline, it only looks bad on you if you don't get it in by February 1st. And then also, here's another opportunity to be nice and respectful of the staff in the medical staff office or the people that you're working with on the credentialing side. They have a really hard job. They have tons of papers. And yet, I find that providers that I've hired will be rude to them as well or just come across as high maintenance. I remember one provider who was just a super high maintenance guy on the credentialing side. And lo and behold, you know, they told me about it. I said, no, I think he's going to be fine. And then he was a super high maintenance provider in our department, whether it's schedule requests or just phone calls and complaints and issues with the hospitalist, just a high maintenance individual. So it gives me a little insight into what your personality is going to be like. Pick a start date and stick to it. So I need staff now. If I'm interviewing you now, I anticipate having a need probably in May or June, and I want you to start, ideally, July 1. You finish residency June 30th. Nobody starts July 1. I know that. I think, particularly if you're moving, it's really fair to take a few weeks off. in most residents now, nobody starts like July 7th or July 14th anymore. But by the end of July, you should be thinking about starting. I probably don't want someone to start in September. Again, I need staff now. In the summer, all of us are going on vacation, and you're just going to leave. You're going to really have your colleagues begrudge you when you start 2 to 3 months later after they've done nothing but work 45 hours a week, and then you come in all rested and tan after 2 months off in the summer. Pick a date, stick to it. If it's August 1st, that's great. Let everybody know, but don't try to bump it after you've picked it. So every doc I interview in the process, I ask them, what's the strengths of your residency and what are some of the weaknesses? Universally, the strengths are critical care. Everybody tells me, you know what? We work in this really sick patient environment. I'm great at critical care. That's fantastic. I want that. But I also want you to address your weaknesses. Most people, whether it's, you know, are you going to be able to read your own plane films in the middle of the night? Are you able to reduce a hip? I never did that in residency. We had ortho residents. Can you reduce a distal radius fracture? How about fast track? What are you there? If the expectation is you're going to see 4 or 5 patients an hour during periods of time in the fast track, are you able to do that? Are you comfortable enough with that non-sick patient population to make quick decisions and get people through the system? So these are all areas that you can focus on over your last, now 9 months of residency, but certainly in the spring if you can get some elective time. So you've done your credentialing. You've focused on your strengths. We've now ticked off a few months, and we are ready to orient. Hopefully your new site director has an orientation manual, and they should be emailing this out to you ahead of time. You should read it. You don't have to highlight and memorize it, but you should be pretty familiar with it. One of the things that I do with all my new hires is a one-on-one review of the manual. It honestly takes about 2 hours. I'm always surprised that it takes that long. There's a lot to go through. I want our people to be very comfortable when they go in and understand some of the ins and outs of the problems. And unless you're transitioning to a hospital where you've been moonlighting, you should definitely make sure you have orientation shifts. What I found to be really the minimum is about 3. We try to give our people 5 or 6. But I think about 3, that at least will get you up to speed on the EMR and some of the basics. Keep a list of key phone numbers. Probably number 1 is going to be your chairman. You want to make sure that you can reach them at all hours of the day in case there's any issues. But also, how about radiology or the hospitalist if you're having trouble reaching somebody? So make sure you have those. And then ask and anticipate problems as part of this orientation process. You know, so where is your backup or rescue airway devices? How does STEMI work? Suppose you can't reach the STEMI on-call doctor. What about TPA and stroke and neurology? And then things like sexual assault or psychiatry. The last thing you want is to have your name associated with a missed STEMI case in your first 2, 3, 6 months out. Almost every STEMI gets reviewed at the chief medical officer level of a community hospital or at the chief nursing officer level. Same with TPA and stroke. God forbid there's a miss, because then the CEO is going to find out. And if that's the first time they're hearing your name, it's really hard to recover from that. I've been at my hospital years. I can probably make a mistake, and they won't think I'm a complete idiot. But if you make a mistake early on, it's really hard to get back from that. So make sure you have a way to troubleshoot that, and you can identify those processes. What happens if there's conflicts with other physicians? The hospitalists are much more likely to push back on you your first couple months than they will after 2 years. So suppose you really want a patient admitted, and the hospital says, no, I'm not going to do it. What can you do about that? And we all go through this, and we all can give you examples of ways to solve that problem. And in general, I'd like to think of these things as just algorithms. You know, what's the algorithm for the psych patient without insurance who needs to be admitted and there's no beds? What's the algorithm when the hospitalist says, no, I'm not going to do that? So you should go through those in your orientation process. And again, keep that chairman's phone number in your phone so that you can get them at 2 o'clock in the morning, 15 minutes into a STEMI when you can't reach the STEMI doctor. I'm going to switch gears a little bit. Communication. Communication is infinitely more important in the community facility than in a residency. I don't remember ever calling a primary care doctor as a resident, so that was a long time ago and things have changed. But then I worked at an academic hospital and supervised residents part-time for about 15 more years. We almost never called community doctors. It was just a standard. It was a difference in the standard. In the community, we call PMDs all the time. You know, we think of these patients as our patients. You know, this is my patient. I'm in the emergency department. The reality is they're also the primary care doctor's patient. We're giving them back to the primary care, and the primary care doctor wants to know what happens with their patients. So we need to let them know on all but really the simplest things. So I think over-communicate is probably better than under-communicating. I get many more complaints from primary care doctors or specialists about, hey, my patient was in the ED. I didn't know anything about it until he showed up, and he had this complication or he has something that needed surgery. So let's say it's 3 o'clock in the morning. You don't have to call them. But what you can do is just make yourself a note and call them at 7 before you go home when you're leaving your night shift. Know who the big fish are. So who are the big fish? So department chairman, president of the medical staff, the chief medical officer if he still sees patients, somebody on the board, somebody with access to that senior level in the C-suite. So I'll tell you the story of one of my part-time docs. He was an experienced doc. He came in to work for me. He did a couple orientation shifts. And then he gets in a fight with somebody over a rectal exam on an upper GI bleed. The attending wanted him to do a rectal exam. He says it's useless. It's not going to matter. And they have a little discussion or fight about this. What he didn't realize or failed to take into consideration is that this attending was the biggest admitter at the hospital. He admitted about 20% of all the hospitalized patients. That gave him a lot of access to the hospital president just from a financial basis. He was also president of the medical staff, which gave him a lot of access to the hospital president. So 5 minutes after this discussion, he walks into the hospital CEO's office and says, who is this idiot down there that doesn't want to do a rectal exam on a GI bleed patient? CEO calls me and says, Mike, who is this idiot you have working for you? Think about those things. And it comes down to kind of access to the CEO or access to other important people in the hospital. So I think it's important to keep track of who the big fish are. What are the key clinical issues? So we already talked about STEMI. In every hospital I've gone to, dialysis and the GI suite are other key clinical issues. There's the first question that the nephrologist is going to ask you at 8 o'clock at night when you say, hey, I have someone who needs stat dialysis. You're going to say, what time did the patient get there? And you're going to say, well, they came in at 2, there was an hour and a half wait, and then I saw them and I wanted to get some labs back and the labs hemolyzed, but now I got the K and the creatinine and they need dialysis. All they're really thinking is, why didn't you call me at 2 o'clock when my staff was there? Now I have to call them in, and they're on call, and they're going to be mad at me. Same with the esophageal food obstruction. The first question they always ask is, when did the patient come in? They don't care if you tried anything. They just want to take care of this. They want to protect their staff a little bit and make sure that things are there. So during business hours, have a low threshold to call them. Check with your chairman when you go orient, but I suspect you'll find the same thing. Those are pretty consistent key clinical issues. Excuse me. Schedule requests, keep it simple. Don't be the biggest headache to the scheduler. You will have infinitely more time in your first year as an attending than you do as a third-year resident. You also are in the age where every weekend could be a wedding. You can't have every weekend off. Don't try to request it. Make sense of your schedule request and, you know, understand what the culture is and what you're allowed to do. 30% of you are going to leave in the first year or two. Try to work for at least a year. When I look at CVs and the person has jumped around a couple times or they've left after 6 or 9 months, I really worry what's wrong with a person. I think there's bad situations and there's bad work environments that necessitate leaving, but almost everything you should be able to stay for a year or two, and it just makes it easier when you go to change jobs down the line. In terms of meetings, initially you're probably only going to be going to your staff meetings. I think it's pretty important that you kind of listen first, offer your opinions, when asked, and then eventually interject your own opinions. It takes a while. It takes some patience, and no matter who you are, to kind of go in and just listen and get to understand the place. So I think that's number one, is wait a little bit of time. Number two, though, is don't be too inflammatory or confrontational, particularly early on. Be careful who you criticize and where you do it. You're not going to know everybody who's walking through the hallway or in the doctor's lounge, so if you're talking about an awful hospitalist and there's someone behind you, you don't know who they are, it's going to come back and look bad on you. So be very careful who you criticize, where you do it, and really keep your opinions to yourself for a little bit or talk behind closed doors to the chairman before you start to get very vocal at meetings. All right, so my daughter's lacrosse coach used to say, early is on time is late, and late is unacceptable. I think that's very true when you do shift work. So when it comes time to showing up for your shifts, if your shift starts at 3 o'clock, that means in the ED, code on, ready to work, signed onto a computer, probably at 2:59. So you got to show up on time. We're a shift work world. Everybody ought to understand that. We're also professionals. We're physicians. We have a job to do, and I think you need to expect to stay late. It takes a lot of skill to wrap things up efficiently and get the phone calls done and figure out who you can sign out and who you can't sign out. And so those first couple months, you're probably staying much later than you will in month 12 or month 15. In my place, almost everybody stays 30 to 60 minutes late. Not unusual in your first few months to definitely stay an hour late, sometimes an hour and a half, because you just are not in a place where you can sign out effectively. Dress professionally. Most residents, you're wearing scrubs, you're working in a trauma center, you're doing a lot of procedures. it's very unlikely that you're going to work in a trauma center. Those community EDs, you have mid-levels that are going to do all your procedures. You're not going to see a lot of trauma. And while you don't need to wear a tie, you do want to at least emulate what the medical director does or ask what the dress culture is. This is Dr. Dave. Dr. Dave's one of my best hires. He was a heavy metal rock star before he became a physician. It's taken me a long time to get Dr. Dave to dress a little bit more professionally. He did get his hair cut. We have a white coat policy, so after years, I've finally gotten Dr. Dave into a white coat, and it's quite a transition. But find out what the policy is and just kind of stick to the dress code. All right, clinical performance. Dr. Dave was the exception. He was one of those guys who was in this fantastic community residency and came out and was productive from day one. Most new hires are not. Most new hires are actually really slow for probably the first 3 to 6 months. If the group average is 2 patients an hour, I can't have you at 1, but I'd like you at 1.5, and I'm not going to give you a lot of pressure early on. Probably 3 to 6 months, you get a hall pass. At that point, I begin to have some data on you, and you should be looking at your data. And you have to understand that while I don't expect you to be as high as the fast person, I do expect you to start to focus on it and be aware of your data. So certainly productivity matters a little bit less so in the first 3 months. You don't hit your peak performance until probably 3 to 5 years, so it does give you a lot of time to continue to improve. But after about 6 to 12 months, you don't have to be the fastest, but you really don't want to be the slowest. Every hospital has VIP patients. Who's a VIP? So all the hospital administrators, the board of directors, they are all going to get VIP treatment in your ED. Your physicians, staff, and families of those will also get VIP treatment. At my hospital, if you're a big donor to the foundation, it's likely that somebody from our foundation is going to meet you in the ED and make sure that you have a smooth course in the ED. And then, depending on where you are, you're going to have probably some famous people. I'm in D.C. We have a lot of politicians. Our doctors are also the doctors of the Redskins, so sometimes you see these really, really big guys walking down the hallway. Or if the Redskins get hurt and they end up in an MRI, and you guys can look through the news and see who would have an MRI at my place. But you can't look. You can't go into these charts. As tempting as it is, you know, your friend had a baby and you want to see what happened or how their course was, you can't go in. It's a HIPAA violation. And so a week or two or a month after the Redskin comes into the hospital and gets his MRI, you know what they do? IT goes into the computer and they identify everybody who signed in and looked at that. It's the same with all the VIP patients across the board. The hospital has an obligation to protect their medical records and their protected health information, so you can't look. And almost every time somebody famous comes into a hospital, there is likely someone who's going to get fired because they accessed it and they shouldn't have. Keep it to yourself if you care for them. As a chairman, I can pretty much go into any case and just say I'm quality reviewing it. And so I think back to we had the underage, intoxicated child of one of our politicians who showed up in the emergency department, and the doc called me about it just to give the PR people a heads up. And although I could get away with looking at it, I don't want to. You can't do that. And he never told anybody else either about it. And it's really important to keep, you know, what's the blood alcohol level, what drugs were they on? It's really important to keep all of that to yourself. All right, switching gears a little bit, quality. So quality is measured. It's measured in 3 different ways. Process measures, outcome measures, and patient experience. So if you go back and look at some of the columns I've written on patient satisfaction, there are a lot of haters out there who aren't going to really buy into patient satisfaction, and that's fine. You don't have to buy into it, but the ship has sailed. It's part of how the hospital is going to get reimbursed, so it's really important to understand it. CMS measures all 3 types of these, and the goal in the future is to really minimize the process measures. So a couple examples of the process measures were what percent of people got aspirin in an MI. Everybody does that at 100%. It's been retired. Prior to that was what percent of pneumonia patients got pulse ox. It's 100%. So that one's been retired. And they're going to focus more on outcome measures. So the Affordable Care Act requires that the quality of care is measured, it's reported publicly, and that it helps to determine reimbursement. You're going to hear value a lot over the next few years. And just to keep it in your head, value is a relationship of quality over cost. So increasing quality, decreased cost is better value. Easy way to remember that. And right now, we're incentivized on volume, but the ACA wants to flip the incentive and have payment driven by value. So why is this relevant to us? Many quality measures we impact. You know, we're either entirely dependent or strongly impacted. So look at something like STEMI, door-to-balloon time in under 90 minutes. huge relationship to the emergency department. Patient satisfaction in the emergency department. Patient satisfaction are the HCAHPS scores on patients that are admitted. So we can significantly impact this, and that's going to affect hospital reimbursement. And ultimately, as the chairman, I'm expected to be aligned and engaged with the hospital on what their emphasis is. That means that all of my doctors have to be aligned and engaged in what's going on and understand the process and understand the rules. So there's three different types of quality programs. A value-based purchasing program, readmissions, and then hospital-acquired infections. So value-based purchasing, that is the STEMI data. That's also where patient satisfaction, so the new ED-PEC, the perception of emergency care. We're trialing that at my hospital starting in January. It'll be rolled out across the country next year. The readmission reductions program. So that's the 30-day readmissions for COPD, pneumonia, MI, hip surgery. I wrote a column on that probably a year or two ago when it was just getting started. A lot of haters. They don't think we have a part. And while we don't have a major part of that, we certainly have a part of understanding it, and if there's a way to keep a patient out, participating with the hospital. And then the HACS, it's the catheter-associated UTI, central line-associated infections as well. So we affect all of these programs. So why is this important? Because all hospitals that treat Medicare or Medicaid patients have to submit data unless you have a waiver from CMS. It's all reported publicly. You can just Google hospital compare and it'll pop up and you can compare your hospital on all of these measures very easily to three of your competitors. And then it has to be publicly reported for a year before it can be tied to reimbursement. So what are we seeing now at the ED is we're seeing time to doc, left without being seen, admission cycle time, all those kinds of things are being reported publicly now. And I expect them to be tied to reimbursement soon. So going from quality to on the big scale to something personal, so bad things happen. So my biggest fear is my first year, killing someone in the ED, sending someone home who dies, and maybe kind of way behind that, but still high on my fear list, was getting sued. This is great if you're in the business model. So this, the blue bars are ED volume. The green line is the number of EDs. So we've dropped from 5,000 to about 4,500 EDs over the last 25 years, while our volume's gone up about 25% from 90 million to 125 million. So from a business perspective, that's fantastic. I have less competition and more patients. We're doing great. From a how busy am I on a day-to-day basis, that's a little bit scary, is you're going to have increasing pressure because of increasing patient volume. Our volume's not going away, so it makes it you're going to be busy. So what kind of bad things could happen to you? We'll talk about getting sued in a second. You can get a complaint. That's pretty benign most of the time. Failing your boards. So most hospitals have something in their bylaws that say you have to be board certified within a certain amount of time, usually 4 or 5 years. So if you fail your boards once and you're now at year two, that means you really have to pass them again. You have to pass them in the next year or so that you can be on time for that. Risk management or a state investigation. So you have a bad case, and you want to you should probably let me know, where the state or your board of medicine sends you a letter, usually certified, and says, we've received a complaint about you. We need you to respond to these allegations. Any letter from an attorney for any of these things, tell your chairman. Get them involved early rather than late. I've had people tell me long after the state's come to interview them, and they've missed that opportunity for me to help guide their answer and take advantage of our experience that we have, or get input from the risk manager or the hospital or your company. So last day, you guys have been filled with information on sepsis and TPA and other things. So I wanted to keep this very non-academic, as you can tell. I have two references. This is number one. So from a few years ago, looking at complaints, twice as many complaints if you were in the bottom quartile in patient satisfaction. And then there was a correlation if you had more than two complaints a quarter, and that's a lot actually, but more than two complaints a quarter, there's a higher likelihood of getting sued. So at my site, the average doc gets one complaint a year. Almost no one gets more than two or three. So in a place where you're getting eight complaints, that's a lot. But you have to be very careful if you start to see complaints roll in on you. Talk to your chairman and figure out what the bottom line is and ways to avoid them, because there are high risks for us. So I was talking to my state's governor some time ago, and I was asking him about malpractice reform. And he said, when are you docs going to get it? It's just part of the job. You're going to get sued. I was pissed. I didn't vote for him. And it's taken me a long time to realize that it really is part of the job. So here's just some of the math. About 7 to 9% of emergency physicians face a new lawsuit annually. Malpractice rates, depending on what you read and who you talk to, I think a good number to think of is about 1 in 40,000. It ranges from kind of community and hospital to maybe 1 in 25,000, very high rate, to 1 in 75,000, a lower rate. But 1 in 40 is a pretty good number to think of. So how do you hit 40,000 patients that you've personally seen? Work 1,500 hours a year. You see two patients an hour. That's 3,000 patients. You supervise another couple thousand at mid-level cases. That's 5,000 patients. That puts your risk of 1 in 40,000 patients about 1 in every 8 years. That's a pretty realistic risk. And you can get sued for anything. I was sued at one point because my last name was Silverman, and there was a Dr. Silverman that took care of the patient. The lawyer, in his infinite wisdom, didn't know which Dr. Silverman it was in the hospital, so he sued us both. Wasn't me. It took 5 years to get dropped. 5 years when I never took care of the patient. So it's a pain, but you will be sued. Why are we getting sued? Most of the time, failure to diagnose. You send home the person with vaginal bleeding, and they end up with a ruptured ectopic, or you miss the appendicitis. Failure to diagnose. Delay in diagnosis. Patients in your emergency department a super long time. It takes you a long time to come up with that diagnosis of appendicitis, and by then it's ruptured. So those kinds of things. It really isn't any one diagnosis that accounts for it. You know, there's no single diagnosis that's more than 10% of these, but it's usually 25% are a failure to diagnose, MI, stroke, aortic aneurysms, and intracranial bleeds. I was out with a colleague last night, and he ran through about a half dozen cases that he's heard about in his own group with aortic dissections over the last couple months. High-risk case. So why are we missing things? Well, often it's kind of a tunnel vision effect. There's three kind of cognitive mistakes. This is reference number two, by the way, for those keeping track. Three cognitive mistakes that we make. So the first is anchoring. We diagnose based on a symptom, first symptom or lab abnormality. An example of this is a colleague of mine took a referral from one of our primary care doctors, had a patient in her office. She was sending over for admission for pneumonia. So the patient was a little sick. I don't want to do a direct admit. They're going to go to the ED. If you could just kind of tee them up, get their labs done, give some antibiotics, that'd be great. So this is easy. You know, if we got to hit two patients an hour, we're getting paid on productivity, this is as easy as it comes. I got a disposition, I got a diagnosis, I got to check some boxes and put in a request for a bed. The problem is he didn't do a thorough history or physical, and when he looked at the chest x-ray, he was a little bit biased on it because he said this is pneumonia. Unfortunately, she was CHF, so she goes upstairs and she crashes and ends up needing to be emergently intubated from a floor bed because she was being admitted for pneumonia. He anchored on that from what the PMD led him to believe. Availability, using a prior experience, what's most available in your memory. And then attribution, so mentally invoking the stereotype. So this one's an easy one that we all do. It's the drug seeker patient who you're like, you're just drug seeking, I know you're drug seeking, here's your Percocet, I'm not going to worry about anything else. And you miss that they have a fever and that their back pain is real and it's really an epidural abscess. So if you're in this long enough, you will at least come across a case like that. So fortunately, we have some tools in our toolbox that we can use to help mitigate our risk. Number one is use evidence-based guidelines and just document the heck out of them. So the PERC rule, the head injury rules, the headache guidelines, all of those things, it's really, really easy to build macros around these in your EMR and import them into your EMR and use them consistently. It helps with your medical decision-making. If something seems weird, get a consult. Atypical presentations, get a consult. Ask another opinion. Be sure that you document your differential diagnosis. Think outside the box a little bit. It's really easy on a headache just to say it's a headache, but it's even better if you can document why you don't think it's meningitis or why you don't think it's a subarachnoid so that your medical decision-making is documented. It takes an extra 30 seconds, but it's going to be critical when you have that bad outcome so that we can go back and help defend you and help justify what you're doing and understand your decision-making. Probably the biggest mistake I see people make when cases bounce back is failure to address abnormal vital signs. Tachycardia is a huge one. You know, it's sepsis, PE. You can discharge people with abnormal vital signs, but you definitely have to address why it's okay that they're going home if they're tachycardic or hypotensive or hypoxic. So make sure you address those and make sure you have a really good reason or do something else to better explain them. You're going to come across discrepancies in the medical record. The nurse is going to write something. EMS is going to write something. You can't cross it out on paper. You can't say wrong. I used to see this all the time, paper triage form. Somebody would just cross out and say that's wrong. Put in your medical decision making that you're aware that the patient told that the nurse, or the nurse recorded that the patient had chest pain, but when you asked the patient said, no, it wasn't chest pain, and pointed to the epigastric area. So just understand that you have to address them all. Follow-up phone calls. How many people, show of hands, how many people do follow-up phone calls on your patients? All right, so a couple of you are my docs, but otherwise that's actually a pretty decent number. I think this is, we do it in large part for patient satisfaction. It is a fantastic risk management tool. You're calling your patient who's discharged. How are you doing? Do you feel better? Are you worse? Have you been able to take your medicines? Are you able to get follow-up? So that way, if the patient's not doing well, you can say, hey, maybe you should come back to the emergency department. It's a great risk management tool. It's even better if you document it, preferably in the chart. You do it as an addendum into the chart or in a formal log that you keep. Sign out is one of the riskiest things that we do when we transfer care to another patient. One of my colleagues at my company, EMA, designed the Safer Sign Out that just got huge national attention last year and is used by a lot of hospitals and groups. It's embarrassingly simple. It's a checklist on paper with a bedside sign out, but make sure that your group has a policy on how you're going to do transfer of care and sign out. And if you want to see what Safer Sign Out is, you can just go to safersignout.com. We all have weaknesses. Use this time to fill your weaknesses. I'm a big believer in vacations. I love the Caribbean. I love going out west. I'm a big believer in vacations. What I don't believe in is kind of linking your CME to vacations. I think it's really hard to focus on CME when what you really want to do is go ski. So take your CME time. Make sure you have a plan for CME and address your weaknesses on an annual basis. If you don't know what they are, what your weaknesses are, ask your chairman, and they will be happy to tell you what your weaknesses are. Culture. You talk about something a little bit more fun. So there's going to be a sign-out culture. Already talked about staying late. Most places in the community, there is a culture of how much of the patient you need to have finished before you sign them out. Very few places will have you stay until everything's done and your board is zero and there's no sign-out. If the patient's going off for a CT and you're not going to have a report for 2 hours, probably reasonable to sign that out. If your patient's back from CT and it just means waiting 10 minutes for a report or calling the radiologist, you probably ought to stay. But it'll take a little bit to figure that out. Productivity. Who picks up the next chart? Is there a protocol? Do you have a pod and you're responsible for all the patients? Suppose you're really slow and you block your pod, what happens? If it's slow in the emergency department, do you take turns? If it's busy and there's five patients up in the rack, what's the culture on how long patients should really wait in the rack before you're feeling the urge where you need to pick them up? So you'll get to know all of that. Is there a hierarchy? Should you expect to have all nights and weekends in your beginning, the beginning of your career, because there is a hierarchy on the schedule? Probably not. You shouldn't have that, but make sure you understand that. So I trained at Hopkins, in a fairly academic place. I was the chief resident. I thought I was pretty hot. It turns out that when I went to my first job, I was really arrogant. I didn't realize that at the time, but I've since been told I was really arrogant and thought I knew everything. Maybe I did. I now know that all of you guys are smarter than me. I don't know everything anymore. But what we do in the community is probably a little bit different than what you do at your tertiary care hospital. It doesn't mean it's better or worse. It's just different. You got to check your ego at the door and understand what's going on. It's all within the standard of care. You will probably learn new ways to manage patients. You will also, I always like to hire new people because I expect them to bring me something new. So we're doing something one way. You're going to bring me what you've been doing in your tertiary care center, and maybe we're going to bring that up and make that part of our clinical pathways. Maybe not. But definitely, there's many ways to skin a cat. We're all going to care for patients a little bit different depending on the environment that we're in. And just understand that you should probably check your ego at the door a little bit and see how it's done there. All righty. So there are definitely people who have thousands and thousands of followers on Twitter or Instagram, and they talk about medicine. I'm going to tell you that you can do that, but why you shouldn't do it, at least on the account with your nurse colleagues. So I really think there's probably no role for this at work unless you have a specific agenda you're trying to drive on what you're doing, whether it's education or politics and medicine or something else. But on kind of the day-to-day, what we regularly use Facebook for at least, probably has no role at work, shouldn't be friends with staff, and no postings about work, and I'll tell you why in a sec. So the hostile work environment, 1964, legally protected characteristics. So these are race, color, religion, sex, national origin, age, over 40. I'm legally protected now. disability, sexual orientation, or retaliation. And what happens is you develop a harassment when a supervisor's harassing conduct results in a tangible change in an employee's status or benefits. So ultimately, if somebody leaves or they can't get promoted, and as an attending physician, you are now the supervisor and the nurse is below you, that's very different from residency, where nurses are probably above the residents in the hierarchy. So when my nurse manager comes to me and says, hey, Mike, I'm worried that one of our nurses is going to file a hostile work environment complaint against one of your doctors, this is a huge deal. This opens us up to lawsuits. And it's really kind of the same thing. So it's discussing sexual activity or telling off-color jokes, commenting on physical attributes, or using crude and offensive language. And think about what you post on Facebook and how it could be interpreted by somebody that you work with who may not have the same sense of humor as you. And one of the problems is that only 15% of our message is delivered by the spoken word. Most of it really comes across as tone and inflection and pacing. There's all these subtle parts of the conversation that we have that does not come across on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter. So it's very easy to offend someone. So your written message, while intended as a joke, may not be interpreted that way. And then it makes it very easy for a nurse to say, this is a hostile work environment. I don't like working with that physician. And if they have to leave, that makes it even worse for them. It makes it even worse for you. So here's an example of a HIPAA violation. 2010, you can Google this, it comes out pretty quickly. So an emergency physician commented on Facebook, no personal information about the case was disclosed, but there was enough that a third party figured out who the patient was based on the injuries and other public information. So what happened? She had an unauthorized disclosure of personal health information. She lost her job, was formally reprimanded by the Board of Medicine and fined by the State Medical Board. That's a pretty big deal, and it's pretty easy for that to happen. So there's some big differences in off to work a night shift. Honestly, that's safe, obviously. But I had a great airway and cracked the chest of a dude who got shot 5 times. What a bloody mess. I think you can figure out who that's going to be. And very different from this one. I can't stand my hospitalist. I don't think anyone needs to be admitted to the hospital. You know what? That happens, and what happens is that makes it back to a hospitalist who's friends with somebody as well, that makes it back to the chief medical officer, and before you know it, the chairman gets a call from somebody in administration and says, I don't want that doctor working in this hospital anymore. And while how that's handled is an entirely different conversation, it happens all the time where a CEO or chief medical officer says, we don't want that doctor here, get rid of him. And it's based on, you know, kind of silly comments like this. So there are some social networks you can use. LinkedIn is a professional networking, very easy to maintain your contacts. It's professional, you're not going to post things, but there are good stories on there. And it will allow you to find other people in the emergency physician community very easily. If you want to have a professional and then a personal Facebook account, go for it. I think it would be too confusing, but I think it's one way to do it where you post things about family and jokes on one side and then have your professional side as well. And then just always think before your post. It's amazing how often somebody will post something until they just didn't think about it. And it ends up, it can be taken the wrong way or seems unprofessional. So how's the hospital know you're doing this? So there's companies out there that have amazing software that scan the entire internet on a daily basis. And they're looking for keywords, whether it's, in my case, Virginia Hospital Center, Arlington Medicine, VHC. We also get everything about our competitors as well. And every single day, the hospital gets a report that's 10 to 20 pages long of every time any of these keywords are identified on the internet and links it to the story. It's usually pretty routine stuff. It's usually, you know, so-and-so reports the birth of their baby at Virginia Hospital Center. But you never know what it's going to find. And that's how they find some of these other things where doctors have been terminated. So email's another just giant minefield. So I'll email my group. The chief of anesthesia has asked me to send out an email saying, please don't use propofol as an induction agent to intubate. You're not allowed to do that. It's not part of your credentials. We use propofol for procedural sedation, so it's in the ED, but we're using etomidate when we intubate. So someone in my group will reply all and say, God, that's so stupid. This is such a great drug. Why would he care? You know, he's an ass. The problem is that I've CC'd him. Yeah. So now I start all my emails with, please note that Dr. Banks is CC'd above, and he's asked me to give you the following message. Hopefully no one replies all to that, and if they do, they at least take him out. Keep it professional. One way or another, you have to assume all email is going to be forwarded. So if you give me an email complaint, and this happened last week, that one of my overnight docs, the ENT, said, I'm not on call. I don't know why you keep calling me. And she says, you are on call. It says so right here. It says, I'm not going to help you. And she writes me a very, very nice summary. And it's very easy for me to forward that to the chief medical officer in the medical staff office or call the ENT and see what happens. And if it's not in a professional format, it makes my job harder. I'm more likely to put it off a day or two or three. Or I have to go back in and edit it. And I've sometimes edited some of my my doc's emails so that I can forward it so it sounds like it's coming from them. But it's so much better when I can say to the hospitalist, the lead hospitalist, hey, look at the email below. Dr. Morris had this awful interaction with one of your docs. I think we need to talk about this and investigate it. It just is better when it comes from you. It's the first person. So keep it professional because it's going to be forwarded. Then ask yourself, can it be misinterpreted? Is this more inflammatory or confrontational than I want it to be? And probably the first piece of advice I got when I became an administrator, and I asked my old clinical director at Hopkins, I said, what's your advice? He's like, if you're really pissed off, wait a day or two. It's too easy to be really upset and type out a 5-page memo on how upset you are. That's just where you look a little bit crazy. Wait a day, keep it down to 2 paragraphs, try not to look crazy. So we all have our phones, we use them all the time. You got Hippocrates on there. There's lots of reasons to have your cell phone out in the emergency department. The problem is that there's probably a cell phone ban for all of your nurses and techs and everybody else. And there's probably a personal email ban for all of them as well. So when you're the doc and you're talking on your cell phone and doing your email and your Gmail's up on your computer, the nurses aren't allowed to do that and it just looks bad. It's not professional and you're being held to a different standard. So at the very least, for your personal calls, leave the clinical area. Try to minimize how much you're using your cell phone and having your email out. Understand what the rules are that the nurses are being held accountable for. So we're in a different position of authority. I said already, you know, as an attending, you're going to be a supervisor to the nurses, whereas as a resident, they're probably above you. So how approachable are you? Are they going to come to you with questions and critical patients, taking phone calls or reviewing EKGs? Because the unapproachable physicians tend not to be liked, tend not to get help, and it can lead to bad outcomes. So late notification by a nurse, late notification on results. So I was working with another doctor, and she was not really liked by the nurses. And she had an asthmatic patient a couple doors down from where I was standing on the table that I worked at. And I could hear the nurses saying, hey, this asthma patient doesn't look good. Should we go tell the doc? What should we do? And they're huddling around. And they don't want to bother the doc. They say, no, the doc's just going to say, give them the nebs, relax, go away. So they didn't say anything. And you can see the patient's getting worse, and they're building up they're overcoming their fear, and they got to go tell the doctor. So if they're waiting to go tell the doctor until the very end, when the patient's now combative and agitated and hypercapnic and needs to be emergently intubated, has pulled out their line. And what they really needed to do is go to this doctor 15, 20, 30 minutes beforehand, but the doctor was unapproachable, and they were afraid they were going to get yelled at. And so they just waited a little bit too long, but it was on the doctor. The doctor has to be approachable so the nurses come up to us so we don't have these bad kind of events. One of the ways that we rate this at my site is we do 360s. We ask all the nurses and the techs and our colleagues, how approachable are we? Are they nice? Are they mean? We use about 10 different questions, including some doc-centered questions that we just evaluate ourselves on. And, you know, are they good if it's busy? Do they show up on time? Do they give a clean sign out? Pretty straightforward stuff. All right, relationships. Learn everyone's name. It's the best way to go in and befriend yourself. I'm awful at names. I'm really bad. And I have to work really hard to do this. But getting to know the secretaries, the cleaning staff, security, it's going to embrace you to them and endear you to them. Treat all your EMS providers well. On average, they bring about $5,000 to the hospital bottom line every time they show up. Give them feedback. You want to be the doc that they're looking for when they come in. You know, hey, doc, we got this great case. Come on in over here. You want that kind of relationship. There are still opportunities to blur the lines. So every social interaction is still a work function. If you go out for happy hour after work, even though it's not a sanctioned work function, you are still the supervisor there. So you have to be wary of that. And all of your interactions need to maintain a professionalism. So you can get into this kind of harmless flirting that you think is really benign, but can ultimately lead to a hostile work environment. We work in a fishbowl. We recognize that from all the patients that look in at us. But we're still in a fishbowl, whether we're at parties, if there's alcohol involved or not. We're still in that same fishbowl, so we still run the same risk. So there are some events you should attend. Every hospital function, every employer function, if your group's having a picnic or a happy hour, go. That's the things that you should do. Certainly medical staff meetings. Every hospital, by joint commission standards, has to have medical staff meetings. You need to go to those to be active on the medical staff. So make sure you go to those. Monthly department meetings, fantastic way to make sure that you understand what's going on, what the direction of your emergency department is. Don't plan your vacation for when the week of the monthly staff meeting. If you're asked to join a committee, say yes. It's easy. It's an hour. Be a good citizen of the medical staff. Absolutely no yelling. It's amazing. I used to work with a guy who was a loud talker. So he talked really, really loud all the time. And if he got excited, he talked even louder. And it just sounded like he was yelling at every consultant. And I would get calls from the consultants, why is this guy yelling at me? There's just no reason. And, you know, it's a tough conversation to have when you pull him into the office and say, you're a really loud talker. You're screaming at me. And he didn't mean to. He wasn't even aware. So let's see if we can wrap up. We got a couple minutes left. So in summary, there are lots of opportunities to screw up. Hopefully you have some ways on how to not screw up and do the right thing. In your first 3 months, you're probably going to generate some kind of complaint. It happens. Your chairman is going to talk to you about it and try to get to the bottom line and figure out what it is. It's often not your fault. Sometimes it is. But we want to address it and just be aware of it. I think if you prepare, you're professional, and you have a really good attitude when you show up to work, you can really minimize most of the complaints. Most of them are really communication-based. Take your time, talk to your patients, talk to your colleagues, be professional, be a good citizen of the hospital. Do feel free to email me if you have any questions. I'm happy to talk to you. And with that, I think we are done. So again, thank you for your attention. Thank you for showing up on this last day. And I'll be around to answer some questions if you have any.